After more than 14 months of circumvention, it was with little fanfare on November 27th that President George W. Bush caved into pressure and signed legislation establishing an independent, quote-unquote, commission to investigate the terrorist attacks on America of September 11th, 2001. The man charged with investigating the failures of the U.S. government to prevent the horrors of that day is none other than Dr. Henry Kissinger. As National Security Advisor to President Nixon and Secretary of State to both Presidents Nixon and Gerald Ford, Kissinger is no stranger to terrorism. As the Council on Hemispheric Affairs wrote in a November 28th press release, Kissinger's selection as chairman of the September 11th body comes at the very time when his bona fides throughout much of his professional life are being called into question by a growing chorus of enraged voices who fear that old age and death will catch up with this public malefactor. Indeed, Kissinger was at least partially responsible for the prolonged war in Vietnam, and he orchestrated the secret wars in Laos and Cambodia. Nonetheless, Henry Kissinger was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1973. He has endured heavy criticism over the years for his role in the coup against Chilean President Salvador Allende in September of that year, and for backing Indonesian dictator Suharto in the bloody invasion of East Timor in 1975. In the early 1980s, he founded the influential multi-million-dollar consulting firm Kissinger Associates, which represents multinational corporations including Coca-Cola, American Express, Anheuser-Busch, and ITT. White House officials say Kissinger will not resign as chairman of the firm and will not be required to release the names of his current clients. Now, with some discussion on Kissinger's record and the likelihood of a cover-up, we now turn to Lucy Komisar. She is a freelance journalist based in New York City, and her area of expertise includes U.S. foreign policy, the international banking system, and corporate secrecy. Lucy Komisar is completing work on a book titled Heroes and Scoundrels, which is about U.S. foreign policy and human rights in several countries, including Chile, throughout the 70s and 80s. Lucy Komisar, I want to thank you for joining us on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Thank you.
I'd like to have you begin by going back to September 11th, 1973. On that day, as I mentioned, Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet carried out a coup overthrowing the democratically elected leader there, Salvador Allende. Could you describe for us in some detail the political reality in Chile prior to September 11th and what motivation the United States would have in removing Allende?
You have to go back a few years to the election of Allende in 70. The U.S. had gotten very concerned because the Chileans, actually under the previous administration, which was Christian Democrat, was taking over the aluminum companies, which the U.S. saw aluminum companies, which they felt was, I'm sorry, not aluminum, but copper companies, were enriching themselves, taking out the copper of Chile and not giving back very much money to Chileans. And so when Allende was elected, the Americans were very unhappy because they thought there would be no rollback in this and that it would actually get a lot worse. So the U.S. Set up something they call the 40 Committee, which Kissinger ran and included the CIA and people from other U.S. agencies, and gave money for people in the Chilean military to attempt to overthrow Allende. The military was led by people who actually were constitutionalists. They didn't believe in overthrowing the elected government, so there was a very hard time had by the Americans, and they did find some people who they thought would get involved in this plot. They ended up kidnapping and murdering the head of the Chilean military, who at that point who did not want to have a coup, and so the coup failed for the moment, but the person who was put in charge was then ousted by the organizers of the right wing, and Pinochet was put in his place. So a few years later, the Americans had somebody that they knew would go along. And at this point, Pinochet led the organizing for the plot, which the U.S. Made it clear through their mechanisms that that this plot would have the green light.
It's a big issue for a lot of progressive activists on the issue of the School of the Americas, now named Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. Is there any evidence to suggest that Pinochet had any direct training from the Americans?
No, I don't think that he had any training. But the U.S. had been promoting this the notion of which came to be known as the national security state, telling the Latin Americans that the big threat was from communism. After all, Cuba had thrown out some its dictatorship in beginning of the 60s, and so the U.S. was very much focused on what was going on in that region, and so it began to focus on telling military that that their enemy was the communists, and they, whether or not they went to the School of the Americas, they were in contact with the U.S. military attachés. They were very close relationships, and the message was clearly given by them.
As you're mentioning, the stated goal was to oust communism from Chile. Kissinger stated in an interview with journalist Elizabeth Farnworth, that, quote, "We were convinced that Allende was heading the country toward communism, and for that reason we did not want to weaken Pinochet at a point where the Allende people would come back," end quote. Was it really about communism, or was this a cover?
No, and actually, well, you know, it was in a funny way, but in a way that people are not aware. Kissinger at that time in the early 70s and before the coup happened, gave a background briefing to journalists in Chicago, and he said that he didn't have any geopolitical concerns about Chile. He had called it a dagger pointed at the heart of Antarctica, which is a joke because Antarctica was not considered exactly a strategic place for the U.S., and it was based on a Hitler quote about Czechoslovakia being a dagger pointed at the heart of the Reich. And, of course, that would have been considered dangerous. But what he was concerned about, you have to remember, this was the time of Eurocommunism. This was a time when there were some alliances being made between communist parties in Europe and socialist parties. Between in France, for example, in Italy, where communists were turning away from being hardline Soviet-style communist parties and in moving, particularly in a place like Italy, towards social democracy. And his concern was that this was a place where a socialist government was actually elected, and this would be a very bad message. What would happen if leftist parties were actually elected? Because, of course, they were being elected in Western Europe. And Kissinger cared about Europe. He did not care about Latin America, but he really cared about the message. He said, "Allende is much more dangerous than Castro because Allende believes in democracy." And so that was really the point.
And these social movements converging, if you will, sort of threaten U.S. economic interests? Is that what I'm understanding?
Well, it was another model, of course. It would be another model, and it could, if it took over in Europe, it certainly would be a threat to the U.S.
You wrote a series of articles in 1999 detailing a lot of this stuff. Can you describe for our listeners Operation Condor? What was that all about?
Well, that was set up by the Chilean secret police headed by Manuel Contreras with the aid of the CIA, and they organized the other repressive Southern Cone countries, including Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, Paraguay, and they set up a consortium, a terror consortium, so that when anyone who they had targeted as an enemy from any particular country went to another country, the secret police of that country would capture the person and murder him or return him or her to the first country. And they even did some operations overseas, killing the police, the general that had followed Schneider, the man who was murdered, and his name was Prats, and he was killed in Buenos Aires. This was the operation that killed Letellier and Moffat in Washington. And Kissinger knew all about this operation. At one point, some people in the State Department wanted him to denounce it, but he refused to do so. It was a terrorist operation. That is the irony, of course, of making him the head of an organization to look into terrorism, because he was quite knowledgeable and did nothing about the Condor terrorist operation.
In fact, there's evidence to suggest, as you documented in one of your articles, that he, in fact, not only looked the other way, but was actively involved in planning and operating that action. Can you talk about a meeting that took place, the only meeting between Pinochet and Kissinger
The coup? I don't know that there's evidence that he planned the operations. It's clear the evidence points to the fact that he knew, he clearly knew about what was going on. I don't think he was picking targets, but of course he didn't have to. That was not his role. His role was to permit it to happen, and initially to have the CIA actually involved in helping some of these organizations find their targets. The memo is quite interesting, because it's another example of Kissinger's attempt to rewrite history, which now is catching up with him. There was a meeting that occurred in Santiago in June of 1996. There was a meeting of the Organization of American States, and Kissinger went to speak there. Mm-hmm. And a memo, which I got declassified a couple of years ago, says in great detail what happened. He went to talk with Pinochet and told him how pleased he was with how Pinochet was handling things, that Pinochet was fighting the communists, and he told him that he was going to have to say a few words about human rights at this big meeting, but don't worry, he was just saying what he had to say, but we really do like what you say. He wrote his part of his memoirs, Years of Renewal, published in 1999. It was just at about the time that I got the memo. It came out just after I got the memo. And his account of the meeting is interestingly based on the same memo, because there were some exact quotes from it, but it was very selective. He distorted completely what happened, because he was just taking out pieces of the memo. And he pretended in what he wrote that he was telling Pinochet that he really had to watch himself on human rights. He really had to take some actions on human rights, and the U.S. is very concerned about what is going on. It was a complete lie. And actually, if people want to see the entire memo, they can go to the Progressive Magazine website, and if you put in the search word for Kissinger or for my name, you will come up with the article, which is called Kissinger Declassified. Put in the search, Kissinger Declassified, and we put up the entire original copy of the 10-page memo, so you can see what he really said.
I'd like to get your reaction to a statement made by Kissinger in a recent interview posed by Lisa Millens of the BBC's The World program, and it's in regards to current issues with Iraq, but it's regarding regime removal, and I think it's quite telling his response in regards to the U.S. role in Chile. And I'm going to play that for you now and get your response in just a sec here.
Is getting rid of Saddam Hussein, or at least a regime change, not a legitimate policy goal for the U.S.?
It can be a legitimate goal in the context of weapons of mass destruction. I would be uneasy if it became a universal goal for the use of American military force.
Uneasy for what reason?
Because I don't think we should use American military force to change regimes simply because we don't approve of the regimes. But again, this is something that you cannot say in absolute terms. There can be a degree of violation of human decency that would cross that borderline.
Lucy Komisar, is this in line with Kissinger's overall role in the coup in China?
Let's just say if there was an international award for hypocrisy, there's hands down the winner, Henry Kissinger. Usually what he has liked to do is to pay or organize some other military to do the job, as in Chile. But, of course, the U.S. actions in Vietnam, which certainly did involve a lot of troops, were clearly aimed at a regime change. So the man is a consummate liar.
In April 2002, while in London, Kissinger was there to deliver a speech, and a Spanish judge asked British authorities to deliver a warrant to question Kissinger about his role in the coup. How is he able to be protected from an international criminal court?
Well, that right now there isn't any international criminal court, and what we now know is that the reason the Bush administration opposed it, refused to sign it, even though they're organizing it now, but it's not been set up, but it's being organized. The reason the U.S. has refused to accept its jurisdiction was not because it worried that American soldiers were going to be targeted. It's come out now. They were worried about Kissinger, and I think they're also worried about Bush, both Bushes, because as the facts come out, we realize that they have been guilty of crimes against humanity, and that's the real reason that the U.S. has been opposed to the International Criminal Court. It will be very interesting to see what happens when the court is set up, and if Kissinger travels to countries where the court is respected. Unfortunately, the U.S., using its bludgeoning tactics, has got a number of countries to agree to have bilateral agreements not to subject the U.S. to the jurisdiction of the criminal court. In some of those countries, though, there are existing national legislation which could subject Kissinger to this jurisdiction just in those countries. And he is indeed very worried. After the Pinochet arrest, he became very, very worried and let some of his friends know that he was very worried. So it's a bit heartwarming to know that in his declining years that he may not totally escape a measure of paying for some of the crimes he's committed. Even if he's never actually arrested, much less tried, he has been subject to a lot of emotional grief because of what has happened, because of the fact that more and more people are talking and writing about what he did.
On that subject, I mean, now that he's back in the fold in regards to the investigation, as heading up this investigation into 9/11, it's highly unlikely that anyone would actually move to arrest him, as you're saying.
Well, I'm not sure if that. I mean, people could move to arrest him, but not in this. He'd have to go to some other countries, and he's probably more limited now in his travels than he would like to be. Mm-hmm. I don't think the 9/11 commission has any effect on that. I mean, what it really is it becomes a joke. It's hard to believe that even the Bush administration is so stupid, because if you set up a commission that's aimed at a whitewash, at least you put somebody at the head of it that has some credibility. But his appointment of Kissinger is being taken as a joke. I mean, it is quite amazing that even very establishment publications have a tactic. You take a man who himself has been guilty of ordering terrorism, and you make him the chair of a commission to look at terrorism, nobody will believe it. I mean, this is a man who spent his whole career lying. Why would anybody believe anything that he said in this commission? It's really an insult to the people who were the victims of 9/11, to their memories, and to their families.
As I mentioned in the introduction, not only did Bush totally oppose this, but eventually caving into pressure, but that you write quite extensively about the international banking structure, and I came across one of your articles looking into some of the financing of Al-Qaeda. Is there any connection at all that maybe possibly tried to be covered up with Bush?
The Bush people are very heavy into oil, and there are connections to the Saudis. And if you look further into that, you will begin to look at a network which shows why they have not wanted to expose the Saudi connection to the financing of terrorism. And some of this is now just beginning to be looked at, but one would not be surprised to find the connections between the Bush oil people and some of the Saudi oil people. The details are not all there yet, but there are lots of very tantalizing clues.
Can you talk about the Al-Taqwa Bank? I'm curious about that. Is there any?
Well, that's not connected to Bush, as far as I know. The Al-Taqwa Bank was set up by people that were connected to the Muslim Brotherhood, and it was set up in Switzerland, also with bases in the Bahamas. Both of these are offshore jurisdictions, and Liechtenstein, another offshore jurisdiction. When I say offshore, I mean a place that has banking and corporate secrecy where people can set up bank accounts and companies and not put down the name of the true owners. And this was used to move the Osama bin Laden money. That they were the bankers of Osama bin Laden. Their shareholders include two of Osama bin Laden's sisters. And they were shut down. After 9/11, they were shut down at the request of the Americans.
I understand.
They were shut down by the Swiss, the Bahamians, and Liechtenstein. Their various companies and offshoots were shut down.
Now, the Kissinger Associates, though, are there any connections there? I mean, don't they represent some high players
in the Saudi
government?
Well, you know,
you
just said yourself.
Hello?
Don't say who their clients are.
Pardon me?
You said yourself a little while ago that Kissinger Associates will not reveal who their clients are.
Right.
We don't know that. We know some of them, but we don't know a lot of them.
Okay.
Very hard to tell what connections they have because they keep most of their client list very secret.
All this is a lot to take in. This is I feel like there's no real recourse to turn this around and get a fair hearing on the events of 9/11. There's quite a lot of information, a wealth of information out there that really points to quite a number of possibilities.
There probably needs to be an unofficial shadow commission, since it's clear that this commission is a whitewash before it begins. It would be a good idea for people to have real concerns, maybe even some of the families, to organize their own commission and try to find some of the truth. There's a very interesting lawsuit that's been filed representing the 9/11 families against many Saudi leaders, princes, banks, including Al-Taqwa, and they, in the process of carrying on this lawsuit where they are entitled to some discovery, they may find out some interesting things. However, I just read that the Justice Department is considering trying to get the entire lawsuit dismissed, obviously because they are afraid of where it's going to go. So that's a possibility, a possible way of opening up information, yet the administration may just block it, cut it all off.
There's been some speculation that I've been reading lately on some internet sites about the possibility that this whole thing with Iraq could just be a warm-up for, 18 months from now when the Kissinger Commission issues its final report. It's going to find some links to Saudi money and that possibly justify an invasion there. Any thoughts on those speculations?
I would find that very surprising. I think it would end up causing a civil war, and that it would cause the overthrow of the Saudi regime, but it would also probably pull in all of the Islamic fundamentalist fighters, and the U.S. would have a major war on its hands, not only there, but it would promote international terrorism around the world. I think it would be extremely dangerous, and Maybe this is, I don't even think this administration is that stupid, and that's saying a lot. You never can tell. But if you wanted to do anything to get the Al-Qaeda group angry and ready to do terrorism, bring terrorism to the point that we have never seen, invasion of Saudi Arabia would be the thing to do it. So I am very skeptical about that happening. And what the U.S. tends to try to do is quietly subvert a country and put in its new man. If it can do that, I don't think it would do an invasion of Saudi Arabia. I mean, what happens is, you know, there's the law of unintended consequences. Look at what happened in the Pakistani elections on the west coast of Pakistan, the west, not coast, but the west border, Peshawar and the northwest frontier, in the northwest frontier province. They had an election recently, and the fundamentalists won. Now, that's the area that borders Afghanistan. During the war, it was the area where the fundamentalists had their headquarters, and that's the area that now voted for the fundamentalists, for the people opposing Musharraf, and for the people supporting the Taliban and Osama bin Laden, who some believe that he has taken refuge there. So it's a very dicey thing to start shaking up another country, especially when you really don't understand what's going on there.
On a final note, I wanted to maybe kind of shift back a little bit to your investigation of Kissinger. Can you talk a bit about how you were able to gain some of the access to this material on Kissinger, and now your thoughts on how recent anti-terror legislation might hinder future efforts by journalists to obtain similar documents?
Yeah, I had been trying to get this memorandum. I had seen a reference to it in some records, but not the memo itself. And so I filed under the Freedom of Information Act, and initially was turned down. So I appealed, and then suddenly a letter came in the mail with this 10-page memorandum saying it has now been re-reviewed and it has been opened. And I had been trying since 1995, and I got the memo in 1999. It generally takes that amount of time. Well, the problem now is under this administration, there have been new rules set, and they're closing off a lot of the documents that were opened in the past. So it will be increasingly difficult to get any kind of information, unless perhaps by accident. But I think part of the problem is that this administration wants to cover up anything that happened in the first Bush administration, and they do not want any. And the other point is that Bush was the vice president under Reagan. We're getting to the point where under the 25-year rule, some of those papers can be opened. Under that rule, we're supposed to be able to see pretty much anything after 25 years. So there's a problem there that this administration wants to deal with, and their answer to all of this is to just lock it up.
Scary times. We've been speaking today with Lucy Komisar, investigative journalist based in New York City. Lucy, you're working on a book, Heroes and Scoundrels.
Well, I'm working now on a book about international bank secrecy. Mm-hmm. International bank and corporate secrecy as it relates to money laundering and international crime, terrorism, drug trafficking. The bank secrecy is the link. The offshore system is the link between a lot of what goes on in the world, in the dark part of the underworld, because whenever you have to move money secretly, that's when you use offshore accounts. It was used in the Iran-Contra affair to move money illegally to the Nicaraguan Contras. It's used by drug traffickers. It's used a good deal by the CIA, including in its funding of Osama bin Laden and the Islamic militants during the war in Afghanistan. It was used by Enron in order to cook the books, and it exists because the very big banks like Citibank, Bank of New York, Barclays Bank, They make a lot of money from it. And that's one of the big undercover fights that most Americans still don't really know about. But it's why rich people don't pay taxes. They hide their money offshore. It's why the rest of us have to pay more. It's something that people need to learn more about, and that's what I'm trying to help in the articles that I write, to get the public more aware of the importance of this system, and also the fact that it's the underpinning to a lot of bad things that happen. The answer, of course, is that we have to dismantle this system.
Mm-hmm. Where can listeners read your articles?
Oh, well, In These Times, I've done a number of stories on this issue in These Times. I've written about it for The Nation. I've written a number of stories for Pacific News Service, and you can find all of these things on their websites.
Great. Lucy Komisar, I'd really thank you for joining me today, and we'd like to keep in touch with you and do another interview on some other subjects regarding your future work.
Okay, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks for joining me today. And indeed, you're tuned in to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 on your FM dial. That was Lucy Komisar, investigative journalist based in New York City. And we were just discussing Kissinger's selection to head up the 9/11 investigations. Right now we're going to be joined by John Miller with more on that topic. John Miller is co-founder of the East Timor Action Network. He has been East Timor Action Network's media and outreach coordinator since late 1996. In addition to coordinating ETAN's New York chapter, John also directs the Foreign Bases Project. He is a treasurer of the War Resisters League and author of numerous articles and pamphlets. He served as staff for the Parliamentarians for East Timor Observer Mission to the 1999 referendum in East Timor. John Miller is also co-founder of Kissinger Watch, a joint project of the East Timor Action Network, the International Campaign Against Impunity, and the Instituto Conosur. John Miller, I want to thank you for taking time out with us today on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Thank you for having me.
Can you first give us a little bit of background? Tell us how you became the co-founder of the East Timor Action Network.
For East Timor is a half island between Indonesia and Australia, and was occupied by Indonesia in 1975, as I'm sure we'll get to, with an explicit okay from Kissinger and President Ford. In 1991, November 12th, 1991, there was a massacre, and unlike many previous massacres in East Timor, there were foreign journalists that witnessed and photographed it. And like a lot of parts of the world, that's brought East Timor's plight to renewed international prominence, and inspired the formation of groups like the East Timor Action Network, which was founded by, for the most part, by people like me who knew about East Timor, knew where it was. Because of that and had experience organizing, you know, various groups felt that this was the time for East Timor to have a group here in the U.S. that could pressure for its self-determination that was denied when Indonesia invaded. And the success story in changing U.S. foreign policy, because now East Timor is independent, U.S. foreign policy changed from what it was in 1975 under Kissinger. And because of that change, East Timor got to vote in a U.N. supervised referendum in 1999. And voted for, as everybody expected it to, for independence. And then despite the destruction that took place in retaliation by the Indonesian military, the fact that the U.S. and a lot of other countries then cut military ties, threatened Indonesia's international loans, encouraged the Indonesian military to live up to its commitment, and in fact allowing an international peacekeeping force and to withdraw from the country.
Let's talk a bit about Henry Kissinger. He's back in the news again. as you mentioned, it's alleged that Kissinger was able to convince President Ford to authorize arms sales to Indonesian President Suharto in 1975, and that, in fact, he and Ford met with Suharto just hours before the invasion of East Timor. Can you give us some evidence to back this claim?
Yeah, I would say there's nothing alleged about it. There are documents, you know, because it's over 25-year-old policy, you know, documents are beginning to be declassified, placed in the presidential libraries. And what they show is over the summer of 1975, and Ford also met with Suharto in the U.S. In the summer of July, I think it was, of 75, the U.S. was in many ways discouraging Indonesia from considering an overt invasion of East Timor. It wasn't that they cared much about East Timor, the rights of the East Timorese people, but they thought that, one, it would spark an international uproar, cause trouble in Congress, and most tellingly, they were concerned that U.S. law and the agreement by which the U.S. supplied arms to Indonesia would require the U.S. to cut off those weapon sales, cut off the Indonesian military's weapon supply. And they were actually using that as leverage. There were all kinds of memos and notes of you know, various State Department officials reporting back that they had were explaining this to the Indonesian military, that this would be a problem. President Ford made a state visit to Indonesia. The invasion itself began on December 7th, 1975. Ford was in Jakarta on December 6th, the day before. And the minutes of that meeting, the State Department, pretty much verbatim report of what was said by Ford and Kissinger at that meeting was on paper, on the record. It's a public document in the Ford Library up on the Internet. And at the end of that meeting, Suharto raises the issue of East Timor and says they're about to invade, and is there any problem here? I'm paraphrasing. And Ford essentially says he doesn't see any problem and not to worry about any repercussions, that they'll handle that. And then, in fact, the documents that have been declassified or leaked after December 7th show Kissinger actively working. He made a public pronouncement about, you know, Indonesia because it invaded the territory of another, in this case, Portugal. It was a Portuguese colony at the time. Indonesia's weapon supply was being cut off, while, in fact, Kissinger was working actively on the scenes, behind the scenes, and to maintain that weapon supply. And in fact, it started up, and the U.S. supplied, you know, far more in the way of weapons after the invasion than before.
As you stated earlier, you sort of mentioned in passing that really kind of the U.S. government wasn't really interested in the rights of the Timorese necessarily. So what was the strategic interest there for the U.S. in Indonesia?
Well, Indonesia is the fourth largest country by population in the world. It's the largest Muslim country in the world. People may be hearing this, have heard this year, particularly after the bombing in Bali. And it's a very important place for U.S. corporations to do business. It has very extensive oil and other mineral resources to which U.S. corporations like Freeport-McMoRan, which is a mining company based in Louisiana,
of which Henry Kissinger sits on
the
board.
Had been on the board.
Had
he
been?
Actually just stepped off recently.
Huh.
Let's see. If all of these companies go through so many name changes, I think it would have been Exxon at the time, or Esso, or whatever it was. Now ExxonMobil, which pumps natural gas and oil in Aceh in Indonesia. You know, large banking interests. And because Suharto, who was very much a dictator in the classic sense, controlled nearly everything, if not everything, that went on in Indonesia, the U.S. felt its policy had to keep him happy. so that he would, you know, grant these concessions to U.S. companies, not charge too much in the way of kickbacks and overhead for those companies to operate. And that was the U.S. strategic interest. And if you look at 1975, what had happened was earlier in the year, the U.S. had pulled out of Vietnam, had this great fear of a domino effect throughout Asia, not just the Indochina Peninsula, and saw Indonesia as a very much an anti-communist bulwark that it could count on in you know, what it then saw as the struggle against communist expansion.
Communism being a euphemism for people essentially wanting to control their own resources?
Yes, yeah, I would say that. But, yeah, and in the case of East Timor, that was very much how it was interpreted. There was an independence movement in East Timor. Portugal had just gone through its own, had just overthrown its dictatorship the year before, and there was a, the military had overthrown him, and a military at the time dominated by leftist officers that had sort of learned their ideology from the rebels in Portugal's African colonies. Fretilin, the main pro-independence party in East Timor, had a lot of the rhetoric at the time of a leftist liberation movement, though not the ideology. And so it was very easy in Suharto's eyes, in the U.S.'s eyes, to see, envision a, shall I say, a mini Cuba on Australia and Indonesia's doorstep. And in many ways, that's what motivated Indonesia, and also not wanting to see any kind of democratic or progressive example next door to this dictatorship. And the U.S. essentially was looking for ways, was happy to make Suharto happy and Indonesia happy by acquiescing to their invasion.
And Suharto ruled for 25 years, is that right?
He took over in a military coup in 1965 with U.S. blessing, and a fair amount of documentation that the U.S. at least at a minimum kept track of the communist and labor and women's organization, various leaders that were captured and killed during the coup. You know, actually kept lists of these people and checked them off as the Indonesians took care of them. And Suharto was finally overthrown in 1998. So we're talking over 33 years.
So after the invasion of Timor, over 200,000 people were subsequently killed in a bloody, you know, in bloody battles over that time. How much of that can we really pin on Kissinger directly then? I mean,
My feeling is, and obviously one can only speculate on how history would have been different, that if the U.S. had not given the go-ahead, Indonesia would not have directly invaded, would not have taken that path. Would have I don't doubt it would have tried to dominate and control East Timor in other ways. I don't know if they would have tried to how... And they had certainly started incursions across the border, you know, prior to the major invasion that began on December 7th. But I think they felt that their relationship to the U.S., and particularly the weapons supply and training that came from the U.S., was more important to them than East Timor. And there's evidence of that because of one... moves ahead to the referendum that took place in the vote was August 30th, 1999, when I was in East Timor. The result was announced September 5th, and you know, the Indonesian military began destroying East Timor, quite literally, and forcing the population across the border into West Timor. President Clinton... on the 9th, and then I think it was again on the 12th of September, made announcements, the first one, a partial one, about cutting off the Indonesian military. The next one, much more total in terms of cutting off the Indonesian military, all training, all weapon supplies, all spare parts in the pipeline. as well as saying it would vote against loans in international institutions like the World Bank and the IMF. Literally within 24 hours of that second pronouncement, Indonesia announced that it would respect, as it had promised to do when the referendum process was set up, would respect the result of the referendum, would begin or with withdrawing its troops, which it did, and would allow an Australian-led, UN-endorsed peacekeeping force, which arrived about a week later, and would renounce its claim to East Timor, which it also promised to do as part of the referendum process if independence passed, which it also did when it its parliament met in October. So, and all of that followed Clinton's announcements about cutting off the Indonesian military.
Clinton subsequently did cut the Indonesian military off, isn't that correct?
Yeah, no, it did. Yeah,
and
when
those
it announced it and it happened and the Indonesian military backed down.
Those ties are again being renewed under the guise of a war on terror?
Yes, so the part of that cutoff of the Indonesian military was just administration policy. Part of it is in legislation that needs to be annually renewed. And particularly with the since Bush Jr. Was selected or came into office, however one wants to describe it, the Pentagon especially has been quite vocal, even more so than in the past, about wanting to renew military training, and it's set up a special counterterrorism training program, which now has a few Indonesian officers in it, has been lobbying vigorously for renewal of Indonesia's access to a program called IMET, which brings officers here. It's kind of the School of Americas for the world. Mm-hmm. And IMET for Indonesia was actually cut off back in 1992, right after the massacre I was describing earlier. What hasn't happened yet, and we'll see now, is that the administration actually hasn't yet started really pressing to arm Indonesia again. And but, you know, prior to September 11th last year, you know, the justification was, which it had always been, we need these ties so we can have influence with the Indonesian military. And as history has shown, the real influence comes when you cut off these things, not when you restore them. And since then, they've added this anti-terrorism clause, which is, you know, kind of illogical and peculiar, because if one looks at the source of terror, just look at the classic definition of it, which is using violence for political ends. It's been the Indonesian military that has practiced that, you know, very visibly in East Timor, but continues to do so in Aceh, particularly in northern Indonesia, which is quite rebellious, and West Papua, which is way on the eastern part of Indonesia, and elsewhere. And in fact, In September, I think it was, prior to the Bali bombing, the Indonesian military ambushed a bus carrying teachers that worked at the schools around the mine owned by Freeport-McMoRan in Papua. And two American teachers were killed and one Indonesian teacher. And independent human rights investigations, the Indonesian police, and apparently, according to leaks, the FBI have all said that Kopassus, which is the most notorious branch of the Indonesian military, its special forces, was responsible for that ambush. So if one is concerned about groups killing Americans for political ends, and there are various theories why that ambush occurred, but you know, here we have fairly direct evidence of the Indonesian military continuing to practice terrorism, not just against Indonesians, but against Americans as well.
Getting back to Henry Kissinger's selection to head up the 9/11 investigation, with all the evidence that you've laid out here, first, is there any way that a criminal case could be brought against him for these crimes?
I'm not a lawyer.
Right.
I mean, what we're involved in is making a political case. There are people that have been actively, not so much for East Timor, but for other parts of the world, for Chile especially, attempt to do this in terms of Vietnam and in London not too long ago. to bring, you know, either civil or criminal cases for against Kissinger. If one just takes the notion that, you know, at the local level of just kind of common crime, if I hand you a weapon knowingly, or sell you a weapon knowing that you're about to go use it to go kill a lot of people, I can be held as responsible for the murders you commit, as you are under most laws, most state laws. I know that's the law here in New York. And it's very clear that, and there's plenty of documentary evidence, that Kissinger knew what Indonesia was going to do with those weapons, and worked very assiduously to make sure they continued to be supplied. In fact, somebody was just at the Ford Library a few months ago, and one of the documents he found there is dated, I think, if I remember right, the invasion was on December 7th. This one's dated December 12th. It's a State Department document. And it lists the weapons, the U.S. weapons that, you know, the State Department analysts believed Indonesia was then using for the invasion of East Timor. So it lists a number of warships that the U.S. had sold, the assault weapons, the M16 kind of rifles, the quantities that the U.S. had recently sold to Indonesia, and just describes them as likely to be now being used in the invasion of East Timor. And, in fact, there's a memo that was leaked a long time ago, I think back in 1999 or 89, published in The Nation magazine, which is a report of a meeting of Kissinger with senior State Department officials, at which he's yelling at them, berating them because the State Department's legal office had written a memo saying that Indonesia was in violation of U.S. law, of this treaty between the U.S. and Indonesia, by which weapons were supplied, by invading East Timor, since all of U.S. law and this treaty said that those weapons could only be used for self-defense. And the State Department analyst, legal advisors were saying, you know, there's no way that this invasion could be described as an act of self-defense. And in that memo, Kissinger makes a remark about, you know, suppressing these communists, you know, be construed as self-defense. But, you know, the main point of the meeting was, why are you putting this in writing? It's going to leak someday. In fact, that original memo has yet to leak. And, that'll just, you know, cause more trouble in Congress and trouble in the press. So he was very much, very fully aware of what Indonesia was doing with, intended to do with those weapons. You know, before the fact, and certainly after the fact, what Indonesia was up to with its invasion and the cost in lives that it was taking.
Well, given this record of behind-the-scenes dirty dealings and attempts to keep stuff under wraps, I mean, what does that say about Kissinger heading up the probably one of the most important, quote-unquote, independent investigations ever to take place in this country's history?
Yeah, if you look at this, I mean, I think what people would hope from this investigation was that it would, you know, serve as a kind of a truth commission about what happened on September 11th. So I understand that, you know, look at whatever intelligence failures took place, you know, whatever realistically could be learned from that. What we know of Kissinger's record is his pattern of behavior is one of keeping secrets, denying lessons from past foreign policy. In fact, when he's questioned in public, not just about East Timor, but about Chile, and people raise a lot of this, you know, criticisms of his record, you know, his first response is to say something along the lines of, this is what makes it so difficult to conduct foreign policy. You know, as people, you know, in his eyes, second-guessing after the fact. You know, obviously, if the information came out at the time, any of those policies would have been blocked or stopped. And so not only does he believe so strongly in cover-up and secrecy as a mode of governmental operation, he very much has a bias against second-guessing policymakers, of criticizing after the fact policies that have been made, especially when they become to fellow Republicans. And so I just can't see fronting anything that's legitimately aimed at uncovering the truth, reporting accurately facts. I mean, he just doesn't believe in facts. And in fact, when it comes to East Timor, when he's been questioned about it, and members of the East Timor Action Network and others, and some journalists have questioned him numerous times over the course of the 10 years that we've been around, he's basically, his response is that maybe the issue of East Timor came up as we were going to the airport. Yeah, it was kind of an afterthought. And, the documentary evidence is clearly that, it was at the end of the meeting, but it was part of the meeting, the formal meeting that Ford and Kissinger and Suharto had. And then his next response is that, and we thought it would go very quickly and peacefully, that it would be like Goa, and which is a Portuguese enclave in India, that India literally just walked in, took over. It was quite peaceful takeover, and the Portuguese didn't protest. But in the case of East Timor, and this was also clear from the intelligence and evidence leading up to the invasion, that there was a fear that, not necessarily that it would take, 25 years and hundreds of thousands of lives, but that the East Timorese were very much prepared to resist the invasion, that the Indonesian forces were going to be especially brutal, and that this was not going to be any kind of cakewalk, and that, the notion, I mean, the Indonesians may have believed in their own minds, some of the generals, certainly who had, very low opinion of East Timorese, may have believed that it would be easy, but no, I can't believe that any, self-respecting intelligence or State Department analysts believe that. And, a lot of the documentary evidence is to the contrary, that they were worried that it would be very high profile and that it would cause problems for U.S.-Indonesia relations and it would cause problems in Congress. And, in fact, all of that came to pass, so it took a well-publicized massacre. And several hundred thousand lives later for that process to begin in the early 90s after the Santa Cruz massacre.
We've been speaking today with John Miller. He's a co-founder of the East Timor Action Network and also a co-founder of Kissinger Watch. Can you give our listeners a little more contact information for both of those organizations?
Sure. You can just go to the ETAN website, which is at etan.org, etan.org. And there's links to our Kissinger page on our homepage, which our 1970 Ford and Kissinger page. One should not forget the role of Gerald Ford, which has links to Kissinger Watch and has links to a lot of the documents we've been talking about. Or they can email etan@etan.org, and we'll put you in touch with people.
All right, John Miller, I want to thank you for joining me today. Any final thoughts?
Oh, thank you. I think that this, I mean, one thing that's been heartening, at least in some of the coverage I've seen about Kissinger's appointment, it has, even the mainstream media has been discussing some of these issues and raising some of these issues. And, whatever Kissinger's role in this current commission, I think it's very important, even if Kissinger is never prosecuted and dies a peaceful death in his own bed, that his record be analyzed and looked at. I think the overall goal is not just to highlight the record of this one individual, but to look at U.S. foreign policy and how it's made, its destructiveness, and at least in the case of East Timor, how it can be changed, that these aren't necessarily lost causes, even when they're described as such. And for many, many years, East Timor was described as a lost cause. I encourage people to take some heart in that.
Well, again, I want to thank you for joining us on Free Radio, John Miller.
All right. Appreciate you having me.
All right.